Hello. Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to ByteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.ByteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my special guest is Monk Yun Rao, and we will be discussing his new book, The Mad Monk Manifesto, A Prescription for Evolution, Revolution, and Global Awakening. Today, it's easy to get outraged by world events, frustrated by our own personal battles, and disenfranchised from government and leadership. Born of moral indignation, informed by decades of study, and seasoned by a life of devoted self-cultivation, Monk Yun Rao's Mad Monk Manifesto has the answers we're looking for, organically cohering personal prescriptions and calls to social and political action in one powerful document. Mad Monk Manifesto is part tour guide to consciousness, part recipe for personal development, part prescription for environmental salvation, and part handbook for social change. In approximately 70,000 words, the book's six chapters follow the traditional Taoist prescription for changing the larger world by changing ourselves first. Yun Rao has been called the new Alan Watts. Born Arthur Rosenfeld in New York City, he received his academic background at Yale, Cornell, and the University of California, and is an ordained Taoist monk. Host of the hit national public television show, Longevity Tai Chi, he is author of more than 15 books, including the award-winning novels Option for Film in Hollywood and Asia. His articles have appeared in Vogue, Vanity Fair, Parade, Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, WebMD, Fox Business News, and many other websites and newspapers. You can find out more by visiting his website, which is monkyunrao.com, and that's monkyunrou.com. And I do have a direct link to that website in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Monk Yun Rao to the show. Good day, sir.
Wonderful to be with you. Thank you for asking me on.
Thank you. Now, I have to ask first, how am I pronouncing? Am I pronouncing that okay, or what's the proper pronunciation?
Well, thank you for asking that too, which most people don't. It's actually Yun Rao. So Yun like Y-O-O-N, and row like row a boat, and you're fairly close to it.
Okay, great. I'll make sure to get that right for the rest of the show. I usually like to start the show by having the guests kind of give a little bit of a background about themselves and kind of how they got to where they are now. So how did a young Jewish boy from New York become a Taoist monk, and can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
So I think, you know, I'm not sure that I believe in fate or predestination, but I think I do believe that there are essential character traits with which we are all born, and each of us unique in that and other respects. And that those traits, you know, they have a little dance with the environment and experience. But in the end, you know, we are born more or less who we're going to be. And it's only a question of how much we embrace our deepest selves as to, you know, how far we're going to get in acting in accordance with our deepest beliefs and proclivities. I mean, I was born a seeker. I was just always somebody who was interested in learning about the different levels of reality, somebody who felt that we were just looking at the surface of the pond and that there is so much more beneath the surface, and I wasn't being taught or shown how to get at any of that. And I think I articulate it now, but, you know, as a child, you can't necessarily say these things, but I think that I probably said that about the pond and the world when I was 10 years old to my parents. And I think they were probably suitably shocked. And I think, too, that, you know, I did have a very unusual childhood, and whether I would have followed the same path without it or whether it spurred me along, you know, this is a question nobody can answer. My father was a very, very famous physician, arguably the most famous heart specialist in the world for 3 or 4 decades of his life. And he took care of kings and princes and captains of industry and Hollywood moguls and all the rest of that, and the people who in those days ran the world. And I got to see those people in a veritable parade through our Manhattan apartment, where they would come to seek my father's medical counsel and sometimes his life counsel. And so what I got to see is up close and personal, these folks who represented everything that we were all told we should want to have or be. So they were, you know, the beautiful people, they were powerful, famous, rich, and all that. They didn't seem so different from the rest of the people I met. And I also noticed that they were not particularly happier than anybody else. In some cases, they were more miserable. And I began to wonder, seeing that, whether what I was being told about what we're all supposed to want was maybe not accurate, and want to be. And of course, once I went down that rabbit hole of questioning what I'm being told about career and happiness and money and life, then I began to ask questions about other things like, you know, religion and politics and society and government and patriotism and all the rest of it. So, you know, you can imagine what a great joy I was to my parents. So, I mean, I think all of this path to becoming a monk was sort of inevitable.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that you kept your parents on their toes with your perspectives. So now, with Taoism, let's you know, talk a little bit about that. I'm not sure many of my listeners have an understanding exactly what that is. So can you share a little bit more about the belief systems of Taoism?
So all of your listeners, and probably you too, know much more about Taoism than you think you know, because we are actually all quite familiar with it. We just don't know it by that name. Its other more common name is Star Wars. And of course, I'm somewhat joking, but actually in the American experience, George Lucas's franchise does bring us into close proximity to a lot of Taoist ideas, because George Lucas was quite a devotee of Chinese culture and philosophy, and he saw this great rift, this great competition between two belief systems in China, one, the Confucian philosophy, which greatly detailed our roles in society, full of rules and regulations about how we should behave with each other, how we should behave to our boss, to our parents, to our children, to our brothers and sisters and friends, and on and on. And it was a very socially prescriptive society, philosophy, but it was very useful for China in keeping the coherence of his culture alive over 5,000 years of Chinese history. But there were people who pushed back against Confucianism and who felt that all the rules and regulations and telling us what to do and when to go and where to eat and what to do and how to behave with each other, which is sort of reminiscent of Orthodox religiosity in some way, all those things were a little bit onerous. And so these people had this group of people who didn't call themselves Taoists, we call them that now, but they were students of nature, and they felt, be free, you know, be an individual, you know, interact with beauty and harmony and animals and plants and the world, and take your lessons from nature, and, you know, be wild bacchanalian partiers and go out into the mountains and meditate in caves and have orgies and study the way the world really works, and don't worry so much about all these prescriptions made by man. And if you think about that apposition of those two ways of looking at the world and those two ways of living, you pretty much have George Lucas's Jedi knights leading the rebels against the Empire with its clone warriors and rules and weapons and structure and all that. So Taoism, as I just described, is a religion / philosophy which has a lot to do with environmentalism. I think it was probably the first organized conservation movement, the first organized environmentalism. And it's a very rebellious, there's a word I'm searching for, but I can't think of it. But, you know, it's very against the establishment. It's revolutionary, and it emphasizes each of us cultivating ourselves and not worrying so much about society's rules.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the idea of it being revolutionary, I mean, from today's perspective, you know, with us being inundated with rules that, you know, kind of, you know, define those rules would make it revolutionary. But, you know, in centuries past, it may not, I mean, maybe not the Confucian kind of perspective, but when at a time when people were closer to nature and lived according to the cycles of nature, it wouldn't have been revolutionary. It would have been more mainstream then.
So I can't say that I think Taoism was ever really mainstream. It was always an educated and elite crew that started out as shamans in Neolithic China, you know, who sat by the water and, you know, watched the river, who paid attention to the flow of energies on the earth, in the earth, and the way the seasons unfolded and the way animals and plants interacted with each other. And it was always the people who chose to engage the natural world first that gave it its power. And, you know, maybe if you go back far enough into Neolithic times, then everybody was a Taoist. But once agriculture became prevalent, agriculture is sort of against the Taoist idea. The Taoist idea, you know, of life back then was what they called free and easy wandering. That's a term that I've read in books written by a Taoist scholar named Livia Cohen, who's a friend of mine. And this free and easy wandering sort of correlates to the hunter-gatherer state. And although life may have been shorter, it wasn't as much shorter than modern life as we are often told it was. And people were healthy. And, you know, could you be wiped out by a blizzard or by a drought? Yeah, absolutely. But the way, generally speaking, the way we live in accordance with nature taught us strategies for living, which are now, even to this day, very useful in our everyday lives. And I'll talk about those in a second, but just one last thing about this sort of insurrectionist idea of and revolutionary character of Taoism. Taoism sees tyranny as the worst idea. So for a Taoist, and this comes straight from one of Taoism's most august and well-regarded tomes, classics, called the Tao Te Ching, which has been translated, I'm told, into more languages more often than any other book in the history of the world, except for the Judeo-Christian Bible. So this book says that the worst leader is the one that everyone fears. A little bit better than that is the one that everybody hates. A little bit better than that is the one about whom everyone is sort of plus minus neutral. But the very best leader is the leader that nobody knows. When I say nobody knows, I mean nobody even knows that the ship has a captain. That this leader, his hand or her hand is so light on the tiller, steering the ship of human society, that we don't even know the ship is being steered. That we all think we're just lucky with the wind and lucky with the currents, and that because we're all just getting along so well, the ship just somehow goes where it needs to go and doesn't run into any icebergs. And that kind of leader, who is personally utterly anonymous, whose decisions and actions and role is almost invisible, that is in Taoism the highest and best form of leadership. And you can contrast that to what we experience today in the world. And so you can see how for Taoists, the rise of tyranny in China, in Russia, in Venezuela, in other parts of the world, and of course here in the United States, is an extremely alarming and an undesirable trend.
Yeah, excuse me, I would agree, you know, that it is extremely frightening, you know, the way that we see many leaders acting and trying to control the people who they're, you know, meant to lead. And I think it's, I love the description of one being a leader, one of the most successful being, you know, one that's virtually anonymous, not being able to tell that they're leading, you know. In that sense, it seems that the people who are being led, in a way, it seems that they may be have a feeling of their whatever it is that is, you know, leading them. I mean, that they might be empowered, you know, that some of the things that are, some of the forces that are steering the ship may be themselves, in a way, you know, that there's not this, you know, forceful, direct, action taken by someone to kind of force them. It's kind of
That's
like
right.
You don't feel like sheep being led, you know, by
exactly.
Yeah.
So I have a memory. I teach a martial art, a Taoist art called Tai Chi, and I have this lovely memory of somebody. You know, I've got a fair sized school. I live in South Florida for some of the year, and have a school here. And you know, I remember having a visitor come to the school and stay for a 3-hour class. And come up to somebody in the class at the end of the class and say, who's the teacher here? And I thought, wow, this was the most wonderful compliment, because for 3 hours, you know, everything has been just going wonderfully. There have been all these little small groups inside the large group, people practicing and working cooperatively on something or another as part of the art, whether they're playing with a sword or they're doing two-person exercises or they're stretching or whatever, but the whole thing has been just proceeding, right, with my hand on the tiller, but, you know, invisibly so. And I took this as a great compliment. I'm not sure that the person who asked the question meant it as a compliment. To them, it may have seemed, you know, chaotic or not what they were expecting from the class. But to me, the fact that someone asked this question when I knew how much good work was getting done, and so did all the rest of the students, was a great compliment. And so I guess, you know, this is the opposite of, you know, flamboyant narcissism and prevarication and divisiveness and false patriotism and all that stuff, which is so common now around the world, sadly.
Yeah, I agree. And it is a compliment, but, you know, I think you're right when it comes to whether the intent was to be a compliment. I think, you know, right now we have been subject to a lot of those controlling types of behaviors that, in a way, we are conditioned to seek that leader, you know, even when maybe it's not necessary to do that.
I think that's a very wise observation. That is certainly true in China, where, you know, totalitarianism is not, I don't want to say it's on the rise, it's fully and totally in place with the attendant loss of freedoms and privacy, and there's mass incarcerations and, you know, secret arrests and an all-pervasive Orwellian society is well underway. And yet there are people in China, as there are in North Korea, who on some level, they know that this is inequitable, they know that this is tyrannical, but on some level anyway, they think that this is for the best, that it's really the best way. It may not be ideal, but it's really sort of the best thing. And so what we have now is we have countries like Russia and China who are essentially like Walmart. And then we have the United States, which is essentially like your local mall, which is, you know, a big place where there are lots of different stores and people say how many different Americas there are. And, you know, each of those stores is a different America. It sells different goods. It has a different style of management. It appeals to a different demographic. It's, you know, it's marketing and advertising and the physical layout of the store is unique and so on and so forth. But unfortunately, and so that is the more Taoist approach, and that is the American way. You know, we have a country that was supposedly founded on ideals and idealism, but was actually founded on, you know, greed and slavery and genocide. And now we have this situation where America is actually just a big supermarket and people come here, the marketplace, they come here to buy or sell or make more money or be able to do what they want to do financially. But we lack, unfortunately, a cohering philosophy that brings our country together. So if you have a mall which has no cohering rules or regulations, there's no map to the mall, there's no coherence to the store from one to the other, then, you know what happens when Walmart comes to town. You know, the malls end up closing. And so this is what the peril for America now is, exactly this. And it is possible to have, you know, this free marketplace and this wonderful shopping mall, but there has to be some cohering ideas to it. And sadly, in the U.S., there aren't anymore. So I'm not too optimistic about our future.
Yeah, Dan, I want to get into that shortly. But I was wondering what inspired you to write this book at this particular time. What was that seed of inspiration for it?
So, I mean, I think I watched the unfolding of events in 2016. And, you know, a monk is supposed to have a certain amount of equanimity, and I hope that I do. I try to. But at the same time, the illusion that a monk needs to be sequestered in a monastery somewhere you know, chanting without engaging the world around him or her, because these same comments apply to nuns, is incorrect. There are many well-known monks and nuns who engage the world fully, and none more politically visible than the Dalai Lama. So it's not that, you know, being involved in the world is something that a monk is not supposed to do. But as I watched the unfoldings with the election and before the election and after the election, I found myself thinking of that bumper sticker that one sees around town sometimes that says, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. Mm-hmm. And so I began to write down some thoughts about the direction that I saw our country headed, the culpability that each and every one of us has for that direction, the perils that lie ahead if we don't change course, and some prescriptive ideas of how to go about making that course change. And in that respect, the Mad Monk Manifesto, which is the book we're talking about, echoes or mirrors the structure of Taoism itself, which says, look, be the stone that is dropped into the pond, a big heavy stone that makes ripples that radiate outward quickly and in an ever-widening radius, circumference. So we begin this work with ourselves, and we begin to question our prejudices, our presumptions, our assumptions, our habits, the things we take for granted, the way we live, the things we believe. We examine everything carefully, and we make changes where we see they need to be made. I call this rectification, like, you know, as in rectifying the problems. Mm-hmm. And then as a result of the work that we have done on ourselves, the changes inside begin to manifest all around us. And those changes start with the people who are closest to us, our family and friends, and then they, in an ever-widening circles, they go bigger and bigger and bigger until in the end we're talking about changes to our nation and changes to our world and changes to the way we look at other living creatures, other sentient beings with whom we share the planet. So that prescription is the structure of my Mad Monk Manifesto, and it's the way that I began writing it, you know, seeing terrible events unfolding and thinking, you know, what contribution can one humble monk make to all this?
Well, you know, the prescription starting with one's own self, that is the one area, the place to start where each individual can literally make a difference, you know, and actually have, you know, the most power is starting with themselves and, you know, making changes and then radiate outward. It's so many times in today's world, people feel they don't have the power or what is it that they can do to make the changes. And sometimes, you know, if you look at society, you know, your community, nation, global, it's hard to wrap your hands around, your hands and head around exactly how I can go ahead and make changes. But starting with oneself, it's easier.
That's right. So, you know, there's three things here. There was an Indian, a Vedic sage, Jay Krishnamurti, who was not a Taoist, but had a wonderful quote about I can't remember the exact quote, but he basically said that being happy and well adjusted to a society that is profoundly sick is not a sign of great health. So when we see all these things wrong, no monk, that no person can feel perfect equanimity in the face of so much tyranny and cruelty and injustice and destruction and outrageous behavior as we see going on in the world. So it's not our mission to be, you know, unfazed or unemotional or unstirred by these things. On the contrary, it's our mission to figure out ways to be galvanized in a productive and effective way by the things that are going on around us. The second thing, of course, is that every religion really offers this same idea, which is that, you know, we start with ourselves and then we see the change that we want. You know, we, as Gandhi said, we be the change we want to see in the world. And then the third point, of course, is that Taoism differs from the Abrahamic faiths in the precision of that prescription. In other words, we're not telling people necessarily to, you know, become in touch with the divine in the Abrahamic sense of that word. But rather, our offerings are a bit more practical, and that's not to say that Taoism isn't rife with deep spiritual ideas, because it is. But the Mad Monk Manifesto, you know, begins with very nuts and bolts things, and it ends with some, you know, exploration of spirituality. But, you know, we talk about diet and how we should raise our kids, and you know, how we should conduct politics and everything from policing to elections. I mean, it's a nuts and bolts prescription. That's why I call it a manifesto.
Yeah, very much. Well, we're about halfway through the show. I'm going to take just a quick break, and I do want to invite listeners that if you would like to call in and ask any questions, the number is 619-789-4359. And then when we come back, you have a not so flowery or perspective of technology or technology. I want to, when we come back, I want you to kind of let us know exactly what your feelings and perspective is on technology in the world, okay?
Thank you.
Great. Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break.
Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, www.biteradio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,200 shows we have had over the past 7 years. Also on the site are links to the products and services we provide, books, greeting cards, photography, and a wellness store. Our show is available as a free podcast on iTunes, and you can subscribe for free at the iTunes Store, or even quicker, there is a link on our website homepage. We are also on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc., and we also have buttons to those platforms on the top of our homepage. Our website, www.biteradio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. Again, today, my very special guest is Monk Yun Ro, and we are talking about his new book, Mad Monk Manifesto, A Prescription for Evolution, Revolution, and Global Awareness. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is monkyunro.com. That's monkyunro.com. And again, I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. And at his website, you can find out all about the many books that he has authored, as well as his work with Tai Chi. So that, with that, we're back. Thanks for staying with me.
Happy to be here.
Okay, great. So let's talk technology. You know, technology is probably about as far away from one with nature as one can be, in a sense. So can you share with us your perspective of technology and its usefulness, I guess, toward, you know, reaching a peaceful and happy environment for us all?
So this is a complex subject, and it's very controversial, and my feelings on the subject are not often welcomed, but I will share them. You made the point yourself a moment ago that technology is about as far as we can get from nature. And there are some people who say that that's bunk, that in fact it is our nature to create technology, and that's what we're on the planet to do. And in fact, there's even a school of thought that we are but a stepping stone in the development of intelligence, and that the soon-to-be so-called super artificial intelligence, which is around the corner maybe, will be something that we can't comprehend, that will be of such power and depth that it eclipses us, humanity, completely, and that it is the ultimate purpose of the universe, which is to sort of give birth to an intelligence deep and wide enough and profound enough to understand itself. And that is a point of view which I understand. I'm not sure that I agree with it. It might be true. I'm not obviously in a position to judge. How do I know? But it's an interesting idea. If that's true, then evolution is just, you know, moving along, and we are soon to be no more important to artificial AI, to artificial intelligence, than ants are to us. And our end is nigh, and that's fine because we did our job. And you know, I don't know what to say to that hypothesis other than I guess we'll have to wait and find out. What I feel about it is that evolution is rife with wrong turns and dead ends. Evolution is not a linear process, but rather it is more like a traffic circle with 1,000 different exits, and only one of those exits works to perpetuate a species. And from my point of view, from Taoist point of view, an over-obsession with technology that enables government control, destroys privacy, destroys our individuality and our ability to concentrate, which deprives us of the one thing that stands between us and tyranny, which is the ability to think deeply about things. Any technology that has that flavor is a danger to us and to the planet, and is the wrong exit from the traffic circle. It is the one that will lead to our extinction, not to our thriving and growing and self-actualizing and flowering. So it's not so much that I am against the concept of technology. That's like, you know, to be a Luddite isn't to be a Taoist. We don't say that every human invention is a bad idea and we should go back to, you know, scratching ourselves in a cave, picking nits off each other and throwing bones, right? So, I mean, we're not saying that at all. But what I try to get at in the book is that we have a choice about the kinds of technology we can develop and how we use technology, in the same way that we have a choice about what to cook for dinner, and that we can make some bad choices that are going to make us sick at the dinner table, or we can make some good ones that are going to be healthy for us and for our families and for our world. So when we consider technology, we have to bring wisdom to bear on the choices we make, bearing in mind that the stakes are very high for all sentient beings on planet Earth.
Yeah, I understand that. And, you know, it's the idea of unbridled technolo- technological advancement without any consideration of, you know, where it takes us as a species can be, I think, frightening, you know, in the sense of, you know, we miss the stopgap points where, you know, we consider the effect on humanity and whether or not, just because we can do it, do we have to do it? You know, it's one of those things where, you know, just because we can, should we? And I think that should we, and all of the implications is something that's missing. And you know, I without that, like you say, particularly the controlling aspects of technology in our life, and the lack of privacy and all of those areas that make us humans unique and individual and independent, you know, those kinds of things get lost in that process.
So it's not just frightening, it's terrifying. And it is a result of shallow thinking and short-sightedness, which are precisely those traits that are being fostered and encouraged in this attention economy, where our eyeballs are what we're being valued for, what's called dataism, where we are being turned just into a set of numbers for industry to use. This is slavery on a scale and of a sort that we haven't really seen before in human experience. To use people not just as chattel for their bodies, you know, for labor or sex or whatever, but rather to use every aspect of our lives and commodify it in the interests of profit and greed is to make a profoundly wrong turn in the history of the human species. And the result, which we're beginning to see now, if you're prescient enough and you pay attention closely enough, the result of being deprived of the time and opportunity and education to think deeply about anything, the result of that deprivation is chaos. It is a world that is not coherent in any way, but is just a bunch of ants crawling around, each chasing a breadcrumb. And when that happens, then humanity is basically over. That the things that made us, the altruism and the intelligence that made us unique, devolves to the point where we are really just violent monkeys bent on our own destruction and the destruction of everything around us. And then, you know, as it's happening now, we behave as a species, as a cancer or tumor does in the human body, producing toxins, out-competing and killing other cells in the body, which, you know, in our cases, other species on the planet, and, you know, destroying our host organism. You know, we're actually literally destroying the Earth. We're setting off nuclear devices. We're cracking the crust with fracking. We're decapitating mountains. We're polluting and drying up oceans and streams and rivers and lakes. I mean, this is an all-out attack on life itself, and it is not rational. So when you say it's frightening, it's way beyond that.
Yeah, I agree. Now, one of the phrases you use is called the tyranny of time, you know, and suggests that we, you know, shouldn't fall prey to that. So in a world where, you know, the whole idea of, for some folks, 9 to 5, you know, Monday through Friday is, you know, their kind of their structured work week, or other people, you know, who have their life framed in many ways by the clock. Can you talk a little bit about the tyranny of time? And then how would we be able to free ourselves as much as possible, you know, from that tyranny?
Well, so tyranny seems to be a good theme in our conversation today, Robert. And also, I think you made a very nice segue from the last topic to this one, because actually these two things are connected. The question of thinking deeply about things and being, you know, sheeple and the tyranny of time are those two things are connected. So if we are constantly kept hopping, if we are buying into a system that has us convinced to buy things we don't need with money we don't have and put ourselves on the debt wheel, and if we are willing to uncritically accept the exchange of a non-renewable resource, time, once we lose it, it's done forever, for a renewable one, money, which comes and goes, we are in the midst of a very bad deal. And the last thing I think that any thinking, feeling, smart person really wants is to be hit by a car, to be lying on the tarmac waiting for the ambulance, to feel our lives leaking out onto the sidewalk, to hear the ambulance in the distance and know somehow that it is coming but will arrive too late, and have as our last thought, boy, I got a lot done. Boy, I bought a lot of stuff. Boy, I work really hard. But what we really want to think is, you know, boy, I had a life. Boy, I used my life well. I connected with people. I contributed to the people I love and to the world and to things that were important to me. I fought for change in the world. I enjoyed myself. I helped others, and my presence made their lives better. But you know, I got a lot done, and I did a lot of shopping. Probably not so much. So insofar as we all know that it ends, and insofar as none of us knows exactly when or how it ends, which means it could happen in the next 5 minutes, you know, we could have a heart attack or get hit by a bus or, you know, struck by lightning or have, you know, a piano fall on our head from a window as we go by. I mean, since pretty much anything can happen, the idea that we might want to consider living in a way that is in accordance with our deepest beliefs, as opposed to just going through the motion, and following someone else's prescription, particularly when that person who is doing the prescribing or that system that is doing the prescribing does not have our best interests at heart. This is a dubious proposition, and I suggest that we don't do it. And so, you know, if we accept that our time is controlled, then we accept that we don't have an opportunity to think deeply, question, and make our own choices. And as soon as we may have accepted all that, we've lost.
Yeah. Yeah, and when it comes to time, it's one of those things, like you say, you know, once we use it, it's gone. You know, it's one of those, you know, resources that we, you know, that we have at the moment, you know, and how we utilize that time is really the important, to me, it seems that it's really the important part of, you know, of this life. I mean, one of the things, I used to be a corporate trainer, and I used to teach time management and, you know, to corporate executives. And, you know, one of the things that seemed to be the most impactful is when they would do a time log and write down things, you know, where they spent their time, how they spent, and just gaining an awareness of how much time they used on useless or, you know, on things and focus that really did not promote their life, you know. And, you know, once that they seem to have that awareness, then there seemed to be a shift in recognizing the importance of making the best out of each moment. You know, even if they had to be at work at 9 to 5, you know, it's how within that time period they utilize that their minutes there. And, you know, I mean, in some cases it may have been having better interactions with customers or clients, you know, higher quality, you know, focus more on the interactions and the relationship rather than the data and paperwork. You know, there were just so many ways that they were able to recognize that I can choose to use my minutes better than I have.
So if you were a corporate trainer who had as your clients corporations whose primary interest was the self-actualization of their workers, then I envy you. Most corporations have as their yardstick for time management how productive are the employees. And in their view, in the corporate view, productivity has no intersection with self-actualization, but rather has everything to do with profit. So I would suggest that if we're really interested, I would submit that if we are really interested in understanding the tyranny of time and the cost of not thinking deeply and critically examining the choices we've made in our lives, that we cannot submit ourselves to corporate masters who, again, do not have any of our interests, not just our best interests, but any of our interests at heart. So we are, you asked me earlier if I could, you know, touch on how we might make some of these changes and what we might do. And the good news is that as a side effect of, or not a side effect, but one aspect of the very technology that I counsel against uncritically accepting, one consequence of that technology is that it does afford us many different choices in terms of gainful employ. With technology and the internet in our lives, there are more and more different kinds of ways to make a living now than there used to be. And so, you know, creativity is rewarded in this area, as it is in many areas. Figuring out ways to pursue the things that we think are really important to us, that match and mesh with our values and goals, and at the same time put a roof over our heads and food in the mouths of our children. This is more possible in the modern world, not less possible. And that is owing to the proper use of technology, which is to use it with the application of the right value set.
Yeah, exactly. Now we're down to toward the end of the show here. So there is one other area that I kind of would like to address a little bit, and that is you being an advocate for elderly. I just self-published a book called The Heart and Soul of Caring, which has stories of 11 different people who were care providers for someone, and the book kind of focuses on the essence of a care receiver, and then the joys and challenges of providing that kind of care. Is there something in your own experience that has led you to focusing on caring for the elderly?
So actually, this is a question that no other interviewer has asked me, interestingly, and I've had quite a few interviews around Mad Monk Manifesto. And I want to use it because I know we're closing in on the end of our time. I want to use it as a pathway to a larger idea. So I hope you'll indulge me with this.
Absolutely.
The bottom line of care for the elderly is that the elderly are us. That all we're doing when we exercise this compassion In Taoism, there are three so-called treasures, and they are compassion, frugality, and humility. So compassion is the care for all sentient beings. Frugality is the wise use of resources. And humility is the understanding that it's not all about us, and that we are not all that. And so this compassion area, it's much easier to be compassionate if when you look at an older person, you understand that it's not that they are no different from you. They are you. But every older person is exactly who we will be if we're lucky enough to live a little while. And that when we disrespect older people, when we are inured to their wants or needs or desires, when we don't consider them, we are absolutely insulting and diminishing ourselves and our humanity. And this confusion about seeing old people as one thing and young people as another is one element of what Taoism considers to be duality. That is, the sense that there is a Yunro, a Robert, who is different and distinct from the people, not only each of us from the other, but also distinct from all the people around us, all the living sentient beings around us, and in fact, you know, the world around us. And this idea of otherness, of separation, is the most pernicious and the most poisonous delusion of all the human delusions. The one that says that we are a separate, sealed up, distinct and discrete entity who has no intersection with all this around us. And that everything we do has to be focused on us and the I and the me. Not only is it selfish and foolish and cruel, not only does it cause us the greatest possible suffering and also those around us the greatest possible suffering, but it is fundamentally and stupendously wrong. It's not actually the way things are. So when we talk about compassion towards older people being compassion towards ourselves, this is a large point. It's not just that we should be nice to older people. It's that there is no difference between them and us. And indeed, there is no difference between each of us and the other. And once we start to see that and see how we are nature and nature is us, and that is one all-pervasive thing, then we can begin to wake up.
Wow, yeah, that's... That I'm glad that you stated that. I mean, that's you know, it's one of those things where I have, you know, just having done the book and hearing from people, there is that differentiation, you know, between us and elders. Some people get it, you know, in the sense of, you know, that is me someday. You know, possibly, you know, yeah, you know, but also that just the humanity, in you know, just basic respect. You know, there's so many times I've just seen, you know, in facilities, some of the workers not recognizing the humanity in the individual who, you know, who they're providing care for, and it just drives me crazy. You know, it's like, you know, this is, you know, this is what you chose to do, and so anyway, but I think
it drives you crazy, and it should,
right? Yeah.
And this is exactly the Krishnamurti quote which I gave you earlier, which is that, you know, it's not a sign of being healthy to be well adjusted and accepting and cool with crazy, terrible stuff in our culture. I mean, that,
yeah.
If it didn't drive you crazy, that would be an issue. If it does, it's fine.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, sometimes it's very appropriate to get mad and angry. So, You know, and you're in for a monk, energy. Get mad.
Yeah. That's right. That's why we have Mad Monk Manifesto, right? Because that kind of moral outrage is a source of energy. If I hadn't gotten excited enough to about the way things were to write this book, then you and I would not be on the call right now.
Exactly right. Well, Yoon, thank you very much for your time today. I've really enjoyed our conversation, and it's really been great, and I'm sure my listeners will find it very informative as well.
Thank you very much for the pleasure and honor of being with you.
Thank you. Again, everyone, today my very special guest has been Monk Yoon Ro, and we have been talking about his new book, Mad Monk Manifesto, A Prescription for Evolution, Revolution, and Global Awareness. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is monkyoonro.com. That's monkyoonro.com. And again, I do have a direct link to his website in the show page description. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me, and our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.